90.7 on your FM dial. If you're in Corvallis or Albany?
Yeah.
Well,
100.7?
It's 91.7.
No, 91.9.
Nine. Okay.
Yeah. That's in the Hood River area.
Okay.
The Gorge. Columbia River Gorge.
So let's get it clear.
Okay.
If you're in the Hood River,
if in Hood River, White Salmon, all up and down the Gorge, as far as we go, that's 91.9.
Okay. If I'm heading south.
Okay. Or if you're heading north up to... I'm not really sure how far we go. I used to know that. I want to say Kalama, maybe?
Perhaps.
Maybe Kalama. Then you're listening at 100.7.
Okay.
Okay. And then if you're on the web, well, you can hear us anywhere. And that would be www.kboo.fm.
Today is Monday, March 27th, 2006.
Last time I checked.
Oh, yeah, well,
unless I did a Rip Van Winkle and I woke up, you know, if I had to wake up, I think I'd rather wake up in the future.
Okay.
I think. Of course, now I was listening to the news and they were talking about Terminator seeds and I was having horrible thoughts of what kind of famine would that bring if that's the only kind of seeds we could plant. And Terminator seeds, and those are the ones they're sterile. They do not produce offspring. So the crop that grows is it. And some of the various genetic research has produced them. And, you know, and I was listening to that on the news, and I was listening to the fact that the United States had won a Most Despicable Country Award. I think it was it maybe Brazil that gave it to us? And, you know, I was just thinking, maybe not the future.
Maybe not the future.
Maybe not the future.
But the future is what we create.
Well, that's what they say about history, too.
Well, and...
You know, and sometimes the quote-unquote version of history that we exalt and hold up may not be accurate. You know, they say that to the victor goes the bragging rights.
Oh, my gosh, this is so incredible. Because
in
a few minutes, we'll talk with Manning Marable.
Ah, yes,
who,
Dr.
His
Manning
last
Marable.
Book is called Living Black History, and he addressed some of these issues in terms of how we remember or choose not to remember history.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, that's an interesting title, too, Living Black History. Is he asserting that it is alive and a living history, or is he asserting that we as Americans are living black history here and now in our current state?
Well,
or maybe a combination.
Perhaps a combination.
Okay.
And perhaps when Dr. Marable gets here, we'll be able to ask him that question directly.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, is there anything that you would like to share with us?
I remember announcements.
I have a stack and I left all of mine in the car. I just realized that. I put together a stack especially to remember. Well, one thing I do remember is that... Oh, no. That one's passed. Okay.
Okay. Well... what we do have are many. Well, this
scrambling
happened
to read the announcements.
This happened yesterday, so
okay, yeah. See, that was the same thing I had. I just realized, oh no, all of those have already happened.
But here's one that those of you who are interested in the issue of corporate power and how to resist. Here's a teaser. The Portland Mural Defense Project is sponsoring a puppet dinner theater and mural show Saturday, April 8th at 2116 Northeast 18th at the corner of Tillamook. There'll be a dinner with Robin Corbeau and the Puppet Ducks, 7 p.m., a presentation by Robin Dunitz from Coast to Coast, a mural show. It's a benefit to Portland Mural Defense. And for more information, contact indefenseofart@yahoo.com. You may be aware that this group continues to struggle with Clear Channel over whether artists can paint murals here or not. There's a trial that has been moved to October 2nd, 2006. There'll be an update at this at the April 8 event, plus good food and good company. So again, to support the artists in our community and to resist corporatism, Portland Mural Defense invites you to an event and fundraiser on Saturday, April 8th. If you'd like more information, you may contact through email indefenseofart@yahoo.com. So that's one particular action that you are able to take and make a difference to support artists here in our community and to resist corporatism and the increased power of a few. Let me remind those of you who are listening that this is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. And those of you who are just turning on your radio, let me remind you that we will have Dr. Manning Marable as our guest today. He is one of America's most influential and widely read scholars. We'll talk with him. He has a column that is syndicated nationally. Has written many books, and his most recent book is entitled Living Black History, How Reimagining the African-American Past Can Remake America's Racial Future. He'll join us shortly, and so we invite you to continue listening and be a part of our conversation, and certainly invite you to listen and to engage in conversation with Dr. Marable. And joining us this morning is a writer who has written a tremendous amount and who has been an inspiration to many. Dr. Manning Marable is one of the most widely read and well-written scholars. Since 1993, has been a professor of public affairs, political science, history, and African-American studies at Columbia University in New York City. He's written over 24 books, I believe. And his last volume, which we hope to talk about today, is Living Black History, How Reimagining the African-American Past Can Remake America's Racial Future. Good morning. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Marable.
It's good morning. It's great to be here.
Yes, thank you so much. You know, many years ago I started a music program, and I would take pains to find your tapes along the color line and play them, because it was just the kind of insight and analysis of both current and past situations that we need to kind of propel ourselves forward, especially as activists in the Pacific Northwest. You need something that's going to help you cut through to the quick.
Yeah, thank you. I started writing along the color line back in 1976 when I was only 26 years old.
Oh, my.
At Tuskegee Institute, Alabama, where I was employed as the chair of the political science department. The idea of Along the Color Line was to do a commentary for and about Black America that would be an independent, progressive voice, and that I circulated the series free of charge, and it still is free. If you go online to www.manningmarable.net, you can download my articles that are available, and it's still free for any Black-owned or oriented or progressive publication on planet Earth. So we're now in about 400 newspapers and publications, periodicals all over the world every month.
Thank you. In a word.
We appreciate so much your work, and also your work in terms of, you said you started your article in 1976, and so for 30 years or more you've been asking the critical questions. In your latest volume, Living Black History, you speak personally and passionately about, I don't want to say crisis, but in terms of how we might remember and reimagine the legacy of Black Americans. And I thought we might begin by having you talk about so-called icons. And what I found was so tragic, well, maybe not so tragic, because of some of the work that you and others have done, is how we've continued to lose or forget our legacy. Not only in terms of what people really stood for, but actually, you know, papers.
Yeah, their material possessions, their writings.
You talked passionately about Maigret Evers and Malcolm X and about their papers that disappeared. I thought you might begin by talking about Maigret Evers and perhaps with some of our listeners to remind them who Maigret Evers is and in terms of why it's important to remember and to grab onto those legacies.
Yes. There were three great civil rights martyrs or black liberation martyrs of the 1960s, Medgar, Malcolm, and Martin. Medgar Wiley Evers was the field secretary of the NAACP in Mississippi for nearly a decade. He held the hardest civil rights job in the country, doing field investigations and documentations of racial atrocities. Without Medgar Evers, we would not know who Emmett Till was. Without Medgar Evers, you would not have had the kinds of successes that were achieved during the struggle, the fight for freedom in the 1960s in Mississippi. And he was assassinated in front of his family, in front of his family home in June 1963. Several weeks after Medgar died, unfortunately, his office was cleared out in Jackson, Mississippi by well-meaning but poorly informed NAACP staff workers. They eliminated and threw in the garbage about three-fourths of his records, his documents, and files. Now, a small amount of material, about four file cabinets full, were placed in boxes and sent to his house. A well-meaning neighbor thought it was simply garbage, and so he took it to the front curb to be picked up. Mm. The trash man picked up one of the boxes, threw it in the rear end of the truck, but for some reason decided not to take the other three. Those are the only three boxes of artifacts that survived. And that's how I was able to write the autobiography of Maigret Evers with Merle Evers Williams that was published by Basic Civitas Books last year. But you see how fragile our history is. Mm-hmm. Malcolm's archives, you're talking hundreds of pounds of information, of his Holy Quran, of his, you know, thousands of letters and documents which he had saved, was nearly thrown into the garbage in Florida, where one of his daughters, Malik Shabazz Brown, transported Malcolm's archives, put it in a Florida lockbox, and then forgot to pay the monthly fee. Mm. That material fell into the hands of a speculator for $600, and he in turn wanted $600,000 for the sale and lots of that material. Living Black History documents how it is that Black history and our intellectual property is fragmented, destroyed, or relegated to the margins. And it also documents how and why it is that the power of the Black narrative, the Black story about our own history, why that continues to be suppressed.
We're speaking this morning with Dr. Manning Marable, professor at Columbia University and author of Living Black History.
Dr. Marable, the title, and you mentioned it just momentarily, Living Black History. Are we talking in terms of the fact that our history, regardless of how fragile it is still alive and breathing in us? Are we sometimes missing the point when we think of it as a relic and as something that happened and was frozen in time? Or is it indeed living and breathing as we are now?
Well, we all make history every day. That's the very first sentence in the book. We all make history every day. We live it. But what that means essentially is that the past is literally being made in the present every day. In Living Black History, what I do is document and tell the Black narrative. There's a story about America everybody knows. that George Washington never told a lie, that the pilgrims came to America seeking religious freedom, created democracy, and landed at Plymouth Rock, and came over on the Mayflower. And so we still, to this day, recreate that image of the pilgrims' first successful year here in 1621 through a Thanksgiving feast, right? Now, what's the black story on the Mayflower? Well, the Mayflower was actually a Dutch ship called the Maybloem. In Dutch, Mayflower is Maybloem.
Uh-huh.
It returned to Holland, and several years later it went to West Africa and brought back a cargo load, hundreds of enslaved Africans whipped, branded, and chained. And so the boat that brought democracy and freedom for white America brought enslaved Africans to America. We know one story, why don't we know the other? It's a simple question.
Uh-huh.
It's a simple question. We know the story about the Mayflower, why don't we know the story of the Maybloem? The same boat that brought slavery to us. Same story that I raise in Living Black History about John F. Kennedy. Everybody knows that the site in Dallas where the former president was assassinated is hallowed ground. Then I raise the question, do black people have the capacity to hallow ground? Is the site where Malcolm X was assassinated brutally on February the 21st, 1965, the Audubon Ballroom, is that hallowed ground? Most of white America would say no. What do we say? Is the site where the Amadou Diallo in the vestibule in the Bronx,
right,
where a young brother was shot at 41 times, struck by 19 bullets, is that hallowed ground? How do we hallow ground? And what is the significance of the symbols we have? Why is it that in North America, in the United States, there is not a single statue or memorial to the transatlantic slave trade and the millions of bodies and corpses of black people that lay, that were hurled into the Atlantic Ocean? Why is there no monument in the United States? Do we have, is our suffering, is black suffering, less than white suffering? Is the sacrifices we made to the country any less? And in fact, what Living Black History documents is that the fight for black freedom has always been the key element in expanding the principles of democracy for everyone. Because without the 1965 Voting Rights Act, the 1964 Civil Rights Act that outlawed racial discrimination in public accommodations, and the 1968 Fair Housing Act, which made, in theory, outlawed racial discrimination in housing and public in those accommodations of living arrangements, that you never would have had the liberalization of immigration that allowed tens of millions of Latinos and Asians to enter this country. The whole debate would never have occurred without the sacrifices of black people. That's what Living Black History tries to document. The story, the other story, that white America continues to suppress.
In addition to suppressing the Living Black History, there's a tendency to rewrite it, to make it in its own image. In Living Black History, you talk about W.E.B. Du Bois and a fascinating beginning. You talk about being asked to be a speaker at a some sort of award ceremony celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Souls of Black Folks.
And that's right. There were 8,000 people. It was the largest sit-down banquet in America. It was in Cobo Hall Arena in Detroit. And I was sitting between next to Russell Simmons on one side, and the head and the governor of Michigan was on one side, and the head of Daimler Chrysler was on the other. And it was interesting that as we had this centennial celebration of the Souls of Black Folk, I wondered how many of these white folk had actually read the Souls of Black Folk, or how many knew that Du Bois in 1951 was arrested, harassed, just brutally by the U.S. government for being a so-called Soviet agent, simply because he had signed a document calling for the outlawing of nuclear weapons. And they didn't call him a Soviet spy. It was ridiculous. But they stripped the man of his citizenship rights. They took his passport away. They burned his books from public libraries. And I wonder, do any of the people here know who Du Bois truly was? Were they trying to frame him in a certain kind of liberal, integrationist, mainstream way, taking away his radical message and his radical and powerful voice? Those are the kinds of questions Living Black History raises.
In addition to W.E.B. Du Bois, this is something that happens over and over again. And I think what I one thing I gleaned from your book is a call to for a new generation to recall and to reimagine our history. And you take to task so-called Generation X, those who were the recipients of the civil rights struggles, and in terms of telling us that we have a real obligation to live up to.
Yes. Yes, I was, as I read it again, you know, sometimes when you write something and you get a little distance from it, I'm a little surprised at how sharp it was, the way that I wrote it. But it's true. That is that you now have with Generation X elements in it have bought into the bogus lie that the only discrimination that exists is now reverse discrimination against innocent whites. You have the Justice Department under Gonzalez carefully dismantling civil rights enforcement and the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. You have seen this past year in 2005 a plummeting of the enforcement of voting rights measures. You have nearly 20% of the Justice Department Civil Rights Division attorneys last year resigned either in protest or demanded to be transferred because the Bush administration is trying to destroy civil rights enforcement. And there seems to be a lack of recognition on the part of Generation Xers that as we speak, literally, tens of thousands of minority sensitive race-based scholarships or race-sensitive scholarships are being eliminated all over the United States, reducing opportunities for hundreds of thousands of black and brown deserving students. And yet, unless we have a clear grounding in the history of our people, we will not be able to argue and put forward a defense which talks about compensatory justice. I mean, you have a system in the United States where there have been four types of what I call racial domains: slavery for 250 years, Jim Crow segregation for 100 years, ghettoization, where racialized minorities were stigmatized and separated off by the patterns of residence of housing through redlining policies by banks, et cetera, practices by banks. And then finally, you have a new racial domain, what I call the unholy trinity of mass unemployment, mass incarceration, and mass disenfranchisement. And that's a colorblind racism of the 21st century. In Living Black History, I talk about the history of the present and how the signs reading white and colored have been removed, but the structures of racialized inequality, the new unholy trinity of mass unemployment, mass incarceration, mass disenfranchisement, conspire to relegate the next generation of young African Americans as a subclass of citizens or non-citizens. In Mississippi, 30% of the black males, because of felony conviction, have lost the right to vote for life. For life. In Florida, 818,000 Floridians were denied the right to vote in the 2000 election, of whom about a third were African Americans.
And some of these without felony charges.
That no, these were people who had
just
prior felony convictions.
So, but Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
So inside of the United States, you have a prison industrial complex where 2.2 million people are currently, as we speak, warehoused in prison. But that doesn't count everybody, because if you count all those who are in prison or jail or correctional facilities, on parole, probation, or awaiting trial, it is 6 million people at any given moment. Any given day, it's about 6 million people. And who is in prison? Look at the recent article in the New York Times a week ago that for black males in their 20s, there are statistically, right now, more black men in prison who are in their 20s than there are who are employed in the United States. Not going to college, employed. All right? And it's far more likely to be in prison than get a job.
Well, you,
so that's the new racial domain of colorblind racism that history is now creating as we live, as we speak right now.
One thing that, in terms of talking about this current racial domain, that somehow I hadn't thought about, that you talk about when talking about the prison population, was that you're right how these prisons are built in rural areas.
Right.
And it did not occur to me that they're in, like, Republican districts, and that the inmates are actually counted as part of the population?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So in New York State, there are about four legislative districts for the lower house, for the assembly, four assembly seats that are prison seats that Republicans, you know, in New York State, 93% of all prisoners are housed in Republican districts. That's not an accident.
Right.
Or the fact that there are 2 million prisoners in the United States, the vast majority, over 80% of them, are in Republican districts. That population is counted as part of the population to determine House membership. Okay? So clearly there is a direct relationship between how the outsourcing of prisons, the jobs that they generate, and the fact that the prisoners themselves, who generally cannot vote except in two states, in Maine and in Vermont, they are counted but don't vote. But it artificially empowers the Republican Party to carry out its draconian three strikes and you're out, et cetera. And so, yes, that's right. This is what Malcolm referred to as strychnology. Literally using people as cannon fodder to support a Republican anti-civil rights, anti-enforcement of the voting rights bill, social justice, all of that kind of agenda, and using prisoners' bodies, body counts, to buttress their so-called phony majority.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. This is More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Dr. Manning Marable, who is the author of many articles and books, but more specifically today we're talking about living black history.
Best.
Well, first off, I think that community radio really is the foundation to what a democratic civic culture is all about. That when we turn on television and we see Fox pledging to be fair and balanced, and yet running to the right wing of George Wallace, a nightly diatribe of polemics and propaganda, we need fresh air. We need the candor and the honest critique that only the community voices and perspectives of real people, real working women and men, provide. And that's why it's so crucial. I should add, by the way, that I am coming to the Portland area in a couple of weeks. I'm going to be speaking at Washington State University over in Vancouver, Washington, right across from you, on Sunday, April the 23rd, at a conference. And hopefully people from Portland and throughout that area will be able to attend and hear more about living black history and the struggle for democracy and against racism. But you've provided just an incredible, invaluable service to making democracy real in a country where it is now in peril. And community radio is absolutely critical.
We're speaking this morning with Dr. Manning Marable, author of Living Black History. He's a professor at Columbia University. Your book, Living Black History, has the famous photo of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X shaking hands. I think it's in Washington, D.C. But it reminded me to think about how we somehow distort our history. Now, in recent weeks, there have been, recent months, the death of Rosa Parks and Coretta Scott King. And many of us were riveted by what took place at Coretta Scott's funeral, and in many ways it visualized some of the things you talk about in your book in terms of how our history is turned around, corrupted, changed, so that I'm not sure Coretta Scott King would have recognized some of the things that was happening.
That was said about her, or happened, right?
By some of, well, you know, her own daughter even. So how do we? And then I went to your website and saw that you've written, and your February article was about Coretta Scott King, and I thought you might want to talk about that and where we are as a nation.
That's right. For our listeners, my website is www.manningmarable, that's one word, my full name, manningmarable.net. And that's where you can access my columns and articles and other material. The King funeral was a six-hour-long kind of a type of pageant in a way, memorializing Coretta, but at the same time framing her in a so-called bipartisan way, with the presence of George W. Bush there, who personally represents all the things that Martin opposed. And it's curious that you have this kind of representation by the nation's quote-unquote leader at this funeral. I'm not sure what Coretta would have thought of it. I'm not sure why the children chose to do it this way. But what is clear is that in the case of King, the King estate makes about seven to eight million a year in franchising Martin's words and image, that the King estate, both Dexter King and M.L. King III, earn about $175,000 to $180,000 a year off of the King Foundation. And which is generated by the visitors to the King Center. So they live off of, in effect, the memory of King. What is painful for me as a historian is how Martin's image and words get truncated and framed around his I Have a Dream speech, which is an important moment in his life, but only a moment. That the King, who was against the Vietnam War, the Martin who was organizing sanitation workers in Memphis, the Martin who had denounced the Johnson administration and who increasingly was attracted to a democratic socialism, a radical economic and social program that would empower the poor in the United States, democratic socialism. That's a King that literally gets wiped out from memory. And you know, you have a travesty this past King Day in January the 15th in San Antonio, Texas, where you have Air Force jets flying over, marking King's holiday, without regard to the fact that King was completely committed to nonviolence, not just as a tactic, but as a philosophy, and he opposed militarism in all its forms. Mm-hmm. That's really destroying the living legacy of King. And in my book, Living Black History, I describe how it is that the authentic black voice and black narrative, the story black America has of itself, is being suppressed, destroyed, fragmented, its intellectual property removed, even its icons framed and packaged in ways that take away the radical elements of their legacy, as in the case of Du Bois, or the internationalism and Pan-Africanism of Malcolm, as in his case, Malcolm X. And it's important to reclaim that history. And that's what my book, Living Black History, is really about. It's a reclamation of the black narrative that can inform a struggle for freedom in which not just black folk, but all Americans can take pride and be empowered by. Because the fight of black people for freedom has never been solely for just ourselves. It has been to remake the democratic project of America itself. That is the real power of the message of the black story about America's history.
How do we encourage in terms of discovering and creating and celebrating the heritage? I know you as a professor and historian do a lot in the community. And in a sense, what you wrote about in sort of recovering the story behind the Alex Haley autobiography of Malcolm X is an example of recovery and truth-telling. Are there ways in which ordinary folks can participate in,
sure.
in creating?
Sure. Everything from oral histories of families and reconstructing our own experiences with a simple tape recorder and interviewing grandmothers, grandparents, relatives about our own past and reconstructing a narrative, a story about ourselves, learning to why it is that it's so important to document and preserve community stories of themselves, the oldest residents in a neighborhood or a community who one can photograph and interview, audio tape, and then digitize those materials and make them available on the web. Creating, whether it's for faith-based institutions like churches or a synagogue or a mosque, an authentic history of those institutions that allows for people to understand and have an appreciation of the evolution of things that are around us every day. So much for poor people and racial minorities, so much of their history gets obliterated because of their poverty and the lack of resources to do that kind of documentation. I think that high schools and in both the social studies courses can make real contributions to the community by engaging in civics projects or community-based history projects that help document and preserve those histories in our voices. Those are practical things that we can do to live history every day.
And those are really significant because they also help when you produce your history on a personal level with your family, help reframe how America looks at blacks and black history. I had the pleasure of collecting information about my dad, who was a who had gone to pilot school through the Navy. And with a conversation with one of my colleagues, he insisted that the times were wrong and that my father couldn't possibly have flown and been a pilot training because all blacks only went through Tuskegee, you know, for the air school. And I had to show him a picture. And it even took him a while then to grasp what I was saying, the gravity of what I was saying, you know, that he had been in the Navy. Here's a picture. This is a Navy plane, naval insignia. These are the times he went to Corpus Christi, Texas. And they framed our history so that it only happens in patchwork, discrete sections that seem to be separate and totally removed from the entire fabric of American history.
That's right. But, you know, this is not accidental.
No, it's not.
You know, like, for example, the Greenwood section of Tulsa in 1921, you had 2,500 African Americans, middle class, upper middle class, very affluent bank. You had black-owned banks, businesses, a real affluent neighborhood. Thousands of racist whites attacked that community in over a two-day period, dismantled it, burned down every building, killed over 200 black people, drove out several thousand women, men, and children, And the crime was suppressed for 60 years. It was not in the history books. You can't find it. There was no prosecution. The state's attorney in Oklahoma did absolutely nothing. The governor did nothing. And so that's a hidden atrocity. In Lower Manhattan, in 1991, as they were expanding the federal building, they uncovered 19,000 corpses of African people who were enslaved here in New York, the African burial ground. For two centuries, we were covered over with cement, bricks, and concrete. And yet, this is a burial ground for 19,000 African Americans. And so our stories get buried over, literally, or destroyed. And that's why, you know, one thing we can do is what is happening in the East. There's an initiative to require the teaching of black history as American history, that all social studies course, all social science or social studies courses in junior high and high school that cover U.S. history and civics must include African American history in those courses. And so New Jersey, New York, and now the state of Illinois have passed these legislation. They call it Amistad, the Amistad Bill.
Uh-huh.
And there's a whole movement to have that kind of legislatively reform of our high school curricula right now. That would be helpful.
In terms of preparing the text, the integrated historical text for that kind of work and that kind of teaching, knowing how hard it is sometimes to have textbooks selected without all of the critical input that comes both from the academic arenas and then the community itself, how is that going to be possible? How are they going to select the text? Who is going to even write the text that's going to honestly imagine, as you,
right,
you have pretty much characterized it, our history,
right,
as both American history and as really honestly portraying the contributions that the black Americans have made?
In New Jersey, there is a state commission called the Amistad Commission. It meets monthly. It draws its membership from elected officials and prominent African Americans and others throughout the state that are supervising the transformation of how history is taught in the public schools throughout the state of New Jersey. The director of that commission is a former doctoral student of mine, I can say proudly, Dr. Karen Jackson Weaver.
Uh-huh.
That's why I know so much about the project. New York State ratified similar legislation. New Jersey's was passed in 2002. So that they are doing, in New Jersey's, summer institutes where they retrain hundreds of teachers on how do you teach it, African-American history as part of American history. They are debating right now whether they should require 3 or 6 credit hours of African-American studies courses that would be necessary to have state certification as a teacher. So there are practical steps that you can do. And what we're finding in New Jersey and New York is that virtually fewer than 10% of all public school teachers have had any background at all in or knowledge of African-American history, taking no courses, don't know it. So even if you put it in textbooks, they don't know it, and so therefore they don't teach it.
Mm.
So getting them to change how you teach the story, the black story about our past, and making sure that white Americans understand that black history is for everyone, that it's not just for black people, that it's for everyone, because there is no American history without African-American history. We're central to the whole story because the fundamental contradiction of American democracy has been that of race. That was the issue that was deviled the country around the Civil War and the struggle around the Civil Rights Movement. And it is the fundamental question that creates that chasm. I mean, you know, Crash won the Academy Awards for Best Picture for a reason. Because it really was evocative of the chasm that is fundamental in the heart of a so-called democratic society, a so-called democracy where the reality of inequality in as it expresses itself in racial terms still exists. That has to be taught. And it has to be taught honestly and objectively from all points of view. Mm-hmm. And the suppression of the black story about America must cease.
We have just a couple of minutes, and at another time we would like to have you again.
Oh, we'd love to invite you back.
Because you just open up a part of how to talk about race in America, and in your book you talk about that in some detail in terms of not only the call for white Americans, but for all Americans to realize that the racial dynamics in our country has changed and find a new creative while remaining true and radical ways in which to address the racial problems. So hopefully you'll be able to join us again and talk us more about how to move beyond what you write in your book, Corporate Multiculturalism, which celebrates everyone while criticizing no one. I love
that's
that.
That's right. No, or Benetton or Walmart multiculturalism,
uh-huh.
where you basically are celebrating difference but not interrogating inequality. It's a multiculturalism that is ahistorical. It's one that has amnesia, that doesn't talk about lynching, doesn't talk about coolie labor in the building of the railroads in the West, doesn't talk about enslavement, doesn't talk about how it was that the Panama Canal was achieved.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't talk about the suppression or the Japanese Americans, the 120,000 that were interned in internment camps, or Korematsu decision of the Supreme Court in 1943. Doesn't talk about, that's the kind of corporate multiculturalism that everybody is projecting right now.
Uh-huh.
But one without any deep historical roots into the tragedies and the complexities of the reality of difference in this country. Difference only matters as it translates into whether or not whether or not we are treated differently in courts of law, for example. You know, that a black youth versus a white youth with an identical criminal, with no criminal record, who commits a felony, the black youth has a 48 times greater likelihood of being sentenced to serve time in an adult correctional facility than a white youth. That's a fact. And so simply by celebrating differences without interrogating why it is that the black youth is 48 times more likely to go to prison than the white youth when they have the same identical criminal records is an abrogation of the search for knowledge and truth. And what history should do is to bring all voices to the table to talk about what we have all experienced in this country. That's what white America, the white corporate America, doesn't want. They don't want a deep interrogation of the past. They don't want a revelation about crimes like, what occurred in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Or
political gerrymandering of districts so that, as you said, the current incarcerated population can't vote, but they count.
That's right. That's right.
What, Doctor? Go ahead.
The prison industrial complex, the fact you've got 2 million prisoners scattered all over the country, nearly all of them in Republican districts, so that they are counted as a part of the apportionment for congressional seats. In New York State, you know, you've got like 4 legislative prisoners districts in Republican areas over 90%. Of all prisoners are located in Republican districts nationwide. It's not an accident. It is a part of a prison industrial complex that is designed to eliminate the votes of black and brown people and to reallocate and to artificially expand the votes of white Republicans. That's a fact. And until we face the truth of our history, of the racialized history we all share, then there is no possibility for racial reconciliation. That was the flaw of Clinton's National Race Initiative, that it was talking about touchy-feely stuff, I love you, you love me, without a deep interrogation of why it is that racialized inequality exists, or without a deep interrogation of the role of the criminal justice system as an engine for reproducing racialized unequal lives.
Well, thank you so much, Doctor, for coming, talking with us. And I understand that the annual spring conference takes place Sunday, April 23rd.
That's right.
Justice in Education, Educating for Justice, with keynote address by Dr. Manning Marable.
On diversity and democracy in education.
Excellent.
Yes.
And for more information, you can go to website T-H-I-E-R-S at vancouver.wsu.edu, or for more information, you can call 360-546-9466. Dr. Manning Marable, thank you so much. We hope we can get you back.
I would love to.
Excellent. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful day.
Take care.
And for those of you who've heard this fascinating conversation with Dr. Marable, there are things that we can do, and that is call 503-232-8818, make your pledge, become a member, and make sure that more programming like this can continue to happen. We need more callers, do we not?
We need lots more people to call and make a pledge. We need you to call right now and make a pledge, 503-232-8818, outside of the metro area, 1-877-500-5266.
Are there any volumes of the book left?
We still have a few of Dr. Marable's books left, so if people call right now at 503-232-8818 and make a pledge, a minimum pledge of $60, they can own one of those books. And so also if you're outside the area, 1-877-500-5266 is the number to call. And I mean, I can't imagine how you wouldn't call after hearing such a clear voice with concrete facts and practical suggestions about what people can do to change the way things are, to bring up the history that is being buried and hidden. And from a person who's grounded in history of today and history of the past, really amazing interview. Thank you, Cecil and Celeste. I think that the best way probably to thank Cecil and Celeste is to call, but I would like to thank
Absolutely.
You personally.
1-877-500-5266. We know you're out there waiting, and you want that personal invitation, and there it is. Call and make a pledge of support for KBOO. Don't you enjoy hearing news and information that goes beyond the facade, beyond the curtain and the veil, and actually gives you some ideas of why you might feel this political and social and cultural discontent and what you can do about it?
So give us a call at 1-877-500-5266.
And the phones are ringing, but we still need some more calls in. And we do want to thank Tremaine and Gail for renewing.
Thank you.
And then there was Raina, who called with an additional gift.
Oh, thank you, Raina.
And Gabe from Portland also called.
Okay,
and
thanks.
People are taking messages right now, but we still need
more. We need
more.
We have an ambitious goal of $800. But really, it's not that ambitious. That's just a few folks calling in and making some heartfelt pledges. This is an opportunity to support a community institution that works for you. We work for you in many ways, not just with the interviews that you hear, not just from the volunteers that come and man the telephones, not just from the news that you heard this morning, but the fact that you, the listener, the member, are able to come in and let us know what kinds of topics are important to you. And if you really have the time and the energy, you can come in and learn how to produce programs about these topics yourself. This is a fantastic opportunity. I can't tell you how rare this opportunity is throughout this country right here. There are not a lot of community-based radio stations where you can come in and make programming that matters to you and your community. We have lots of ethnic programming. We have lots of political programming, cultural programming. We have lots of music programming that is beyond the ken of what you will find in most commercial, corporate radio stations. They can't handle what we do.
No, we have
one phone line open, and the volunteer is rubbing her hands together, waiting to answer it. If you need the number out there, 503-232-8818, or if you're further away in Hood River or outside the Portland area, just call 1-877-500-5266. We're waiting for your calls so that we can continue to hear Cecil and Celeste, so that we can continue to hear this quality programming and the commitment that they will be there again, that they will bring back this guest and others so that we can continue our education as a community.
And you know what? Somebody picked up that phone, but there's now a new open line.
Oh, that's right. Keep those lines
just
filled
for you.
Up.
Keep them coming.
We're waiting for you to call.
503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-5266.
What do you like best about being KBOO volunteers, Cecil and Celeste?
Oh, my goodness.
I love the opportunity of meeting people such as you, and just the diversity of people and their commitment to working together to create a better community.
Yeah, I like that. I like the fact that you can get charged and refreshed by coming together with a bunch of community activists. And even if we're not necessarily working on the same cause, it's just that activist fervor that matters. There's so many issues out here in this community alone we could challenge. But you can get worn out, you can get tired, but you can come back to KBOO and you can remember why you're working on things. You'll hear one news story and it really galvanizes you and activates you and gets you ready to roll. You know, that radio activism is important.
Indeed. If you feel charged up after listening to this interview, now's the time to show us by making that phone ring at 503-232-8818. And we have lots of listeners outside the Portland area. So that number to call is 1-877-500-5266. It's toll-free.
Wow. Toll-free. And if you want to do it on the Internet, well, my goodness, of course it's toll-free. And I know we have in the past had special Internet specials, you know, opportunities for people who pledge. And, you know, you can take a look at www.kboo.fm and see if there's anything there that grabs you. Make that call, make that pledge, make that call for support right now.
Do I hear a phone ringing?
Not at this moment, you don't.
There we go.
You must be psychic, Cecil.
Now, we know that there's a flood of people out there who want to be connected and who appreciate great programming and who want to be supportive of a radio station that, as we said, brings them news, information, and entertainment they cannot find anywhere else. I want to thank Crystal and Trillium for coming in and co-pitching with us here. You know, you kept us alive and energetic. We want to thank our engineer, Richard for his hard work.
Every week.
Yay, Richard. Every Monday, he is down here. You know, it's volunteers like that that keep KBOO alive, along with you, the member. So, if you're already a member, get somebody else radioactive. Have them call 503-232-8818. Or you can give a gift for somebody.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, give a gift to KBOO for a $40 gift. Hey, you can get the listener's guide. You get your little KBOO membership card. You get a little flashy card. You can get a cheaper latte. So for giving up one latte a month, you can get the rest of them cheaper.
Excellent. So if you're outside the Portland metro area, call 1-877-500-5266.
Yes, help us make our goal. KBOO's goal is the goal of bringing you news, information, music that entertain and inspires and educate you. So, do that. Make that call. And here on More Talk Radio, we will hear you next week. Call, support, KBOO now.